Garrett Cole's opted out of his deal with the New York Yankees, and they should let him walk to free agency. Yes, welcome on in to First Pitch for Monday, November 4th, your source of news, notes, and updates on Major League Baseball. I'm your host, Lindsey Crosby. Follow me on Twitter at Crosby Baseball. He's Christian Rao. Christian S. Rao, R-A-U-H, on the Twitter machine. And Christian, a lot of stuff happened over the weekend. A lot of stuff is going to happen today. This is a big day for MLB. The exclusive negotiating window with your own free agents ends at 5 p.m. Eastern time today. So guys can officially sign then. Qualifying offers are due by then. We're going to get to some of those prominent free agents. We're going to get to the qualifying offers. We're going to get to the Gold Glove winners. But I want to talk about Garrett Cole, because just like Garrett Cole opted out of covering first in game five, or in the fifth inning of game five of the World Series, Garrett Cole has opted out of the rest of his deal with the New York Yankees. Cole has 4 years and $144 million remaining on the deal he signed in December 2019. Now, the Yankees can exercise a club option to add 1 year and $36 million to the deal to retain him. But I think we both think that they probably should not do that.
Yeah, first off, with all the news this weekend, I'm surprised that we're going to even be able to remotely get this around a half hour today. We could easily have had a five-hour show and still probably miss something. There was so much news that happened over the weekend, Lindsey. But I think you're right. And I think when we talk about Garrett Cole, first off, hilarious about what you said. He opted out on game five, also opted out with his contract. Anthony Rizzo, his option was declined. So there's a possibility that both players in that that blunder of a play will not be a New York Yankee next year. But I do think Garrett Cole should walk. I think the Yankees should let Cole walk to free agency. He's 34 years old. If you give him one more year, okay, fine. I guess I could see it. But when you look at that type of money, and I know we're talking about the New York Yankees here, when you talk about money, yes, I get them. They usually go hand in hand. They're usually a handshake that we see with these two teams that are, or these two, this organization that we know that's not a problem. We saw with the Dodgers as well. But when you see a 34-year-old pitcher who, of course, had an interesting season. He was great last year, obviously won the Cy Young. This past season had some injuries. Then when he came back, especially in the playoffs, was still good. There's still some good things behind him. But you look at the rest of this free agency market, Lindsey. You're talking about the New York Yankees. You're going to have a really big, you know, influence on bringing free agents in. You're also talking about a Boris client. And I'm pretty sure the major Boris client that you want to bring in is not Garrett Cole. It's Juan Soto. So when the fact of the deadline coming up today, 5 p.m., I think the deadline is for Garrett Cole, the 5 p.m. Eastern. Yankees, I think you have to let him walk and you focus your complete sights on one person and one person only. If the reunion is possible with Garrett Cole, sure, that's fine. But I don't think it has to happen by today. I think you see what the free agency holds for the New York Yankees. And if you can bring back the 35-year-old pitcher, then so be it. But I don't think you have to bring him back on a $36 million deal. Because if New York Yankees don't sign him, is somebody else going to sign Garrett Cole for $36 million in 1 year? I'm not sure you do. I'm not sure that happens.
Here's the thought process for me on letting Garrett Cole walk. And I mean, you made some great points. Like the Juan Soto money is more important, right? But the first thing is, if you guarantee that 2029 salary for Garrett Cole, he will be the sixth pitcher to have a starting salary for 2029. And let me give you the rest of the list. Aaron Nola, age 36, he'll have 2 years and $49 million remaining. Yoshinobu Yamamoto, Spencer Strider, Brian Bellow, Hunter Green. The difference in all of those guys and Garrett Cole, with the exception of Nola, is they're all on the other side of 30. So, like, this is one of the rare deals. I made this point on Twitter, and some people pointed out that I forgot about Max Scherzer with the Nationals. But it's very rare that you see a pitcher sign around age 29 or 30 to a massive deal and it actually work out, right? I mean, this has been a good deal for the New York Yankees. He's pitched at a 3.12 ERA. He's 59-28 and 125 starts over five seasons. This has been a very good deal. The issue you always have with those long contracts is they don't age well, right? You get great performance in the first half, and then the second half's a giant albatross. And you can go through so many names that have been in that situation. I mean, Albert Pujols is a great example of a contract that, you know, looked really good when he signed it, and then by the end was an awful deal, right? This is an opportunity to get out from under that deal. And there's other things to think about. Like, for instance, Gerrit Cole's velocity has been steadily decreasing. His average fastball velocity has been lower in each of the last two seasons. He won a Cy Young last year, but his average fastball velocity was lower than in 22. 24, it was even lower than 23. And granted, he had the elbow issue like you alluded to. His spin rates, same thing. Spin rates on his, you know, on a lot of his pitches have been going down consistently for the last couple of years. Most pitchers start to decline in their mid to late 30s. And rather than committing $36 million a year on a dude in his decline phase, you can get out from underneath that. You have more funds free for a guy like a Juan Soto who you want to bring back. Yep. And maybe even if you do bring back Juan Soto, you can redirect the Gerrit Cole money to somebody who is significantly younger than him. You can go sign Corbin Burns. You can go sign Max Fried. You can go sign Blake Snell. There are other options in free agency this year and probably next year that you're not paying solely for the decline phase in, like you would be for Gerrit Cole, who it is likely, not a guarantee, but it is likely is not going to be able to live up to his first half performance in his second half of this contract.
I would argue that the Yankees are at an inflection point right now, Lindsay, with the fact that Gerrit Cole and how that contract is. There are a lot of baby bombers coming up right now. You talk about Jason Dominguez. You talk about some of the other pitching prospects coming up.
Volpe and Austin Wells.
Exactly. There's a lot of players that are young in this assets of the New York Yankees. If Gerrit Cole resigns and stays till 2029, I think that would impact them negatively moving forward, maybe moving away from him. Now, this might be an emotional decision for you Yankees fans, but maybe moving away from him is the right thing moving forward. Pitching wasn't a problem for the most part in the playoffs, but there were some concerns because you had some injuries. Gerrit Cole wasn't one of them. He was your best pitcher in the playoffs. Don't get me wrong. But there are some other aspects and other problems that you need to fix and move forward if you want to return to the World Series. Pitching will be one of those for the future. And getting younger, as you mentioned, I think should be a primary focus. Gerrit Cole should be a free agency or should be a free agent in 2025, and he should not return to the New York Yankees.
Now, here's the hard part. Is it likely that Yankees pitching takes a step back in 2025 without Gerrit Cole? Probably. I don't think Carlos Rodon's really good as a number one. I really do think if you let him walk, you need to go grab somebody else, right? You need to go get a Fried, a Burns, a Snell, or somebody. But it's not about 2025. It's about 2027, 2028, 2029. Is Yankees pitching in a better position there by paying $36 million for Gerrit Cole? I think we both don't think it is. And so the right thing to do is to let him walk in free agency.
In 2029, if the Yankees have a couple World Series with Gerrit Cole on their back, then obviously then they're not going to care about this conversation. But if we're in that same boat as we are right now, and the Yankees are still trying to fight for a World Series, whether they're in contention or not, year in and year out, when we get to 2029, we're talking about what happened with a 40-year-old pitcher over the last 5 years compared to possibly being in the same exact situation we are right now with a guy like Corbin Burns, who's entering his age 35 season around that time. And then you have another decision to make like you have right now. So I think you go ahead, you shut the door on Gerrit Cole, you move on, you get younger. Mm-hmm. And I think that's important for the Yankees this season.
From a team potentially moving on from their best pitcher to a team that did not pick up an option, but is not also not moving on from their best pitcher. Devin Williams had his club option declined by the Milwaukee Brewers. So reminder what he did here. This was his second year. 2024 was his second season of arbitration. He signed a one-year $7.25 million club option or contract with a $10 million club option for 2025. I thought Devin Williams, he was injured going into the year. And so while he pitched to his normal regular season standards, 1.25 ERA, 14 saves in 22 games for Devin Williams, kind of matches his career ERA is 1.83. He had a 1.53 last year, a 1.93 year before that. Obviously, he wasn't around nearly as much. And then he once again struggled in the postseason. His postseason ERA, 23.14 in three career games. The Brewers declined the option on Devin Williams, but they'll be able to take him to arbitration. And this is frustrating to me because having a club option on him that you decline and having the ability to just go to arbitration for a lower salary frustrates me. It feels like if you have a contractual option on a player, on a contract that you offered to them and they signed, and you declined that option, you should not then be able to take them to arbitration. My position is if you have a club option, that club option is declined, the player should be an unrestricted free agent because you had the option to keep them in your organization and you chose not to. But MLB Trade Rumors says that Devin Williams is projected to make around $7.7 million. Do you think that this is a smart move by Milwaukee, a bad move by Milwaukee, or does it not matter because they're going to trade him anyway?
I think they're going to trade him anyways, but I think it's a smart move by the organization. I think it's a crappy move by the organization. I will say that.
Two things can be true at once, right? Like financially, right. It's a smart move. In the clubhouse, it's a terrible move.
Yep, agreed there, 100%. The reason I think it's a smart move on the organization's behalf is you are going to lower the valuation of Devin Williams salary-wise, meaning that because he's still going to be a quote-unquote rental when you do trade him, it's going to be a lower cap hit on the team that's picking him up. So you are probably going to get more back for Devin Williams when you do pick that trade up because people are going to be more willing to go and trade for him because you're getting only for seven-ish million instead of 10-ish million. That could change the fact of maybe one or two more teams entering the bidding war for Devin Williams. Look, this is a guy that had 65 saves over the last three seasons, Lindsay. He's no pushover. And in 2022, he shared those saves before Hader was moved. So there's a lot of he's got a lot of good baseball in front of him still. I know he only had 20-something innings this year because of that back injury, that bizarre back injury that he started the season off with. But he looked fine when he returned. He looked like there was no issues. I think that we're going to see him back stronger than ever in 2025. He's only entering his age 30 season. He's a reliever, so this is a whole different conversation than we're having about the Gerrit Cole situation. And he's 5 years younger, too. Whoever he gets traded to, going to a contender, you know, he's obviously going to get moved there. He's gonna do just fine. But for the aspects of the Milwaukee Brewers, I think this is a good decision. It worked well for what they did last year at Corbin Burnes. They brought in some more players. They retooled. That's their type of strategy. They don't go for the big type of free agents. They go for players that have high upside. They work them really well. And then when they're up for contract extensions, they either make the tough decision and do that at a decent deal or they move them. We saw it with Burnes last year. It's not surprising. It's not surprising that they're doing this. It's just the way they're doing it. It's just a crappy look.
Yeah, this is something where, from an organizational perspective, right, they understand that they're probably not going to be able to re-sign him in free agency, so they're lowering the cost so they can move him. And I feel like, as a fan, that's frustrating. But at the same time, a lot of the Brewers fans I've talked to, and our Discord has a ton of Brewers fans in it, by the way, they understand these are the limitations that our organization works under. I'm hesitant to say that any organization can't afford to sign a player they want to sign, but they understand these are the limitations our general manager has to work under, right? So I get it, but I do think it's really tough on a clubhouse, right? To see, I mean, they talked about they were in the playoff hunt and they moved Josh Hader to deadline. And kind of like the team talking about the impact that that had, how tough that was to trade Josh Hader. I think this is another situation like that where I hate this for Brewers fans. The organization made a smart move financially, but I do think that this is not the kind of thing that goes over as well in the clubhouse as they would expect. And Will they still be competitive next year? Yes. Will they still contend for the division? Yes. But is there probably some free agent out there who's going to be a little more hesitant to come to Milwaukee because of this? Probably also yes. It's also interesting that like Willy Adames didn't have this happen, right? They kept him all year. He's going to walk after a qualifying offer. I think the difference here, again, assuming that Williams gets traded, is the qualifying offer and the fact that you're not going to give any reliever a qualifying offer and have over $20 million committed to that guy for a season if they take it. So I think that's kind of the difference here. You're expecting a qualifying offer to go to Willy Adames, but you wouldn't do one for Devin Williams next offseason.
When you look at the Brewers and how they're set up right now, I think Williams would be considered the fourth or fifth highest contract on the organization, you know, heading into with the $10 million deal. With seven, I think it's probably one or two positions lower. Is that something when you look at the team big picture, Lindsay, are you willing to make that a reliever, a top five guy? Based on, we're not talking about the Yankees or the Dodgers here, where that's like a normal thing. We're talking about the Milwaukee Brewers, where you know, salary is a little different. Are you willing to make a reliever that type of high contract money?
Yeah, that's the tough part. I mean, you very rarely see relievers signed to huge deals. And when you do, it's the absolute best. Your Hader, your Edwin Diaz, things like that. And I would argue in both those situations, you've seen instances of those bullpens not having enough depth. Like, look at the Astros in 24. They signed Hader to one deal. Yeah. They lost three key relievers and only replaced those three guys with Hader for about the same amount of money as all three signed for. And so, and you can see the weakness there. I fully am on board with not paying a reliever $100 million, not paying $20 million a year. It's just, it's got to be frustrating for Brewers fans knowing he's probably gone. Okay. Gold Glove winners were announced last night. There's some notable stuff here. Looking at the National League, Christian Walker wins, I think, his third consecutive at first base. The Arizona Diamondbacks. Patrick Bailey continues to be the best defensive catcher in baseball, wins another one for the Giants. Matt Chapman at third base, two Giants win it. Ezekiel Tovar wins his first at shortstop for the Rockies. Chris Sale wins his first career Gold Glove for the Atlanta Braves. Feels like he's kind of a shoe-in for the Cy Young there. While the American League, you have some Alex Bregman, pending free agent for the Astros, wins his first career Gold Glove at third base. Bobby Witt Jr., Stephen Kwan continues his streak of left field Gold Gloves. Which Gold Glove result I think was the most surprising from the awards announced on Sunday night?
I don't know, surprising, because the depth of National League center fielders are just huge, but I'm surprised that Jacob Young for the Nationals didn't win it over Doyle. I thought he was a shoe-in. I really did. I thought that he was the best center fielder all season. Nothing away from Doyle. I mean, what we have in the National League among center fielders is just outrageous. And then
it's the most stacked that position's been in a long time.
Yeah, for sure. And then I personally think Mason Wynn deserved a little bit more love at shortstop for the National League over Tovar. I think that might just be a little bias on my side. So regardless, the biggest thing, National League center fielders, I was surprised when I didn't see Jacob Young's names and I saw Brenton Doyle. Yeah. But congratulations to Doyle. I am so excited for what we're going to see for the next 5 years, National League center fielders. It's going to be so fun to watch that. Pete Curl Armstrong, Michael Ciani. I mean, you name it. There's just so many of the different just – we're going to have a new Gold Glover every year. I think that's just going to be something we're going to have for the next 5 years, Lindsay.
Yeah. To contextualize this, Jacob Young in StatCast, plus 20 outs above average, was number one for all center fielders. Brenton Doyle was second at 16. So plus, like, beat him by 4 outs above average. To taking out Kevin Kiermaier, who changed leagues, of the top 12 outs above average finishers, kind of scrolling through here, I believe off the top of my head is right, all but three of these guys are National Leaguers. Jose Siri of the Tampa Bay Rays at plus 16 was third. You had Jake Myers of the Astros at six. And then you had Kyle Isbell of the Kansas City Royals at 12. Everybody else, National League. This is an absolutely stacked position. Michael Ciani of the Cardinals was third. Pete Crow Armstrong was fifth. Siani was fourth. Just an absolutely stacked position. Jackson Merrill, who moved from shortstop to center field to start the year, was
first eighth. Year ever as a center fielder.
Blake Perkins of the Brewers was ninth. Michael A. Taylor was 10th for the Pirates, although now that's going to be O'Neill Cruz. That'll be a fun one to watch. Harrison Bader of the Mets, who I believe is a free agent, was 11th. Michael Harris II was 13th, despite missing multiple months of the season. So the gold glove in the National League is going to be probably, honestly, my favorite award to watch from all of the gold glove positions for the next decade, because all of these guys are super young and they're super talented. It's incredibly exciting more. To watch. Yeah, it's yeah. This is just going to be tons of fun here for me. So we'll definitely watch that out. 14 first-time Gold Glovers, tied with 2022 for the most in a single season. The caveat there is 2022 was the first time they added the utility player in each league, so you had two additional Gold Gloves to give out. But this is the fifth straight season with at least 10 first-time Gold Glove recipients. So, all right, let's hop into quick pitch real quick. A lot of little quick things to get to. The Royals agreed to a 3-year contract extension with Michael Wacha, including a club option for 2028. He had existing a 2-year deal with a club option he could have picked up on Monday. This could be guaranteed 3 years at $51 million. And an additional $14 million club option for 2028. Good idea, bad idea for the Kansas City Royals.
Love it. The Kansas City Royals are finally spending money. They're finally building around their foundation.
And it worked. Junior. They made the postseason last year.
And what did they have the year before that? 100+ losses, right? They swung around. They did the Baltimore Orioles of 2024. That's what they were this season. It was really exciting to see what this team could do. And they're not done yet. They have a lot of little pieces. I think that you're going to see them be a sneaky team this offseason. I think they're going to pick up maybe not one of the biggest names in baseball, but when they sign players, you're going to be like, man, that fits perfectly. I really like what Matt Cotaro and the rest of the Royals front office is doing. I think it's really exciting to see what they're building around Bobby Witt Jr. And then you look at this rotation now. Cole Reagans, Seth Lugo, Michael Wacha still being your 1-2-3. That's awesome. That's really awesome. I don't think they're done, especially with that rotation too. Pay attention to Kansas City, because I think we're going to continue to see them turn into an American League, not even just American League Central favorite, but American League favorite going into 2025. This offseason is going to be very crucial for them. And getting Wacha right off the bat is huge. I really like this pickup and really like this extension for them.
I love what the Royals are doing. Five of the 10 largest contracts in Royals history are with four players on the current roster, right? Now, Lugo's $45 million. Yeah. Both of Salvador Perez's extensions, Bobby Witt's $288 million extension. Five of their 10 largest contracts in team history are currently on the roster. And if you are a small market team, and I use small market in air quotes because these are all massive cities, and you argue that you cannot afford to be competitive and sign players in free agency, the Kansas City Royals are proving that you are a liar and that you are just trying to make more money for your owner. I love what the Royals are doing. I want them to continue. And I do think they have a legitimate opportunity to take that division, because we're going to perpetually count out the Guardians because it feels like they never are aggressive enough in signing players and they somehow continue to make it happen. But it feels like for the next couple of years, we're going to be saying, hey, have the Royals added enough to take the division this year? I absolutely love it. Other kind of news coming up here. The general manager meetings start this week in San Antonio. Really interesting time, because today is a really big deadline. 5 p.m. Eastern, as we mentioned, that is when free agency officially begins. Your exclusive negotiating window, your quiet period, if you will, is over. We probably won't see, I don't know if we'll see any signings or not, simply because all the GMs are together and it's something where a lot of agents are in San Antonio. You're going to see a lot of deals come together here. Qualifying offers are due at 5 p.m. as well. A lot of guys, we expect to get them. I think my list here, I kind of went through, I've got 8 different players I think are locks to get a deal. Juan Soto, Alex Bregman, Willy Adames and Pete Alonso. Let me see. For hitters, Teoscar Hernandez, Anthony Santander. I think those six will all get offers. For pitching, I've got Corbin Burns, Max Fried, and I think that's about it. Blake Snell can't get one. He's had one in the past. I think that those eight, those are your locks to get qualifying offers. There'd be some other interesting ones. Sean Manea will probably get one and decline it. But like, does Jurickson Profar get one? Does Christian Walker get one? A couple interesting decisions there who we have to figure out. And then we have seen some trades made at the GM meetings, but does it feel like we're going to have a lot of trades made, or does it all depend on Alex Anthopoulos of the Atlanta Braves?
Yeah, I mean, he already started off strong, right? Based on what we had this past weekend, we might have 16 trades, Lindsay. The type of traffic that we had already with baseball news this weekend was quite overwhelming. To say it in the slightest, I think that it was really tough to keep up with. I mean, we haven't even touched the surface of all the things that have gone on. It's probably going to take us the entire week. So for the sake of the show, I hope it slows down a little bit so we can dive into some of these topics that's already happened across the baseball world. But as a baseball fan, I hope we get a million trades in San Antonio. Oh, yeah. I hope big things happen. I hope they decide to just turn on MLB The Show. And then, you know what? Actually, let's just make this our official roster while we're at it. There's a lot of really fun things that have happened already with options. We've seen Cody Bellinger opt into his player option. I think that's a really interesting move for the Cubs.
I was about to go to that one and ask about it. Player option for, I think it's $27.5 million. And he picked up the option after, where was it here? I had the stats a second ago. Here we go. After batting .266 with 18 home runs in 130 games, playing all three outfield positions. He played center field a lot until Pete Crow Armstrong came up, and then he played a lot of both corner outfield and first base. Good move, bad move. Do you think the Cubs are happy about this or bummed about this?
Yeah, let me answer your question with another question, Lindsay. Jed Hoyer stated at the trade deadline this summer that he was not going to be aggressive and he was going to focus on 2025 and beyond. He did not move Cody Bellinger, although many thought that he was going to be a New York Yankee like his dad. Never happened. So I'm guessing that they're okay with this because they never moved him. So I think they were expecting him to opt into his player option. You got to think they probably had a one-off meeting before the trade deadline. That's why they didn't move him. But is this fit into Jed Hoyer's 2025 and beyond plans?
I think my big concern now when it comes to this roster is your sources of power, right? Ian Happ in left field is, I think, a really underrated player in baseball. Batting average was only .243, but he hit 25 homers, won a gold glove in left, gives you a lot of everything. Michael Busch hit 21 homers at first base. Seiya Suzuki hit 21 as your right fielder in DH. But do you have enough power given the fact that you don't get a lot of production out of your catchers? You don't get a lot of power out of Nico Horner at second base. Revolving door at third base, you hope that Isak Paredes can give you more power. That's not a great ballpark for him, though. Do you have enough power to win on this roster, or do the Cubs kind of have to lean more into the small ball, be good at base running, which they just hired a really good base running coach as their third base coach? Do you have to start doing the other things to win? Because the question I'm trying to ask, I guess, is this just keeping Bellinger, seeing him opt back in, is this just an acknowledgement that, hey, our ballpark is not great at hitting for power? We're just going to lean into other stuff.
Yeah, it's a really good point. And, when you look at the way that the Cubs are rostered and constructed, there's a lot of young players coming up as well. They have a ton of prospects as well. So adding a guy in like Cody Bellinger, he might just be a one more year stopgap. But he seems to love Chicago. He has resurrected his career after what happened at the end of his Dodgers tenure. And that's pretty great. It's pretty great to see. I will say this. We talked about the GM meetings coming up. If we have a trade, I wouldn't be surprised to see the Cubs be involved in this one. Jed Hoyer sounds like he wants to make a big aggressive push for 2025 and beyond. That's all he talked about in the second half of the season when he was stepping up. He had his eyes looking forward to next season and beyond with the organization. How can you not with the 8 or 9 top 100 prospects in the organization that the Cubs have right now? but there's not room for every single one of those prospects on the major league roster, and they're knocking at the door, Lindsay. I think they need some back of the rotation help with the pitching staff, and I think they can help other ways as well. I would not be surprised if the Cubs are one of the first teams to make a big splash with a trade, potentially in San Antonio this week.
Yeah, it's just really tough to figure out position player wise how you fit guys in there until injuries knock somebody out of the lineup, because everybody's coming back. You've got four outfielders when you include Suzuki. You know, you've got your infield kind of every position's full except for however long it takes Nico Hoerner to get back to form after his shoulder surgery. I mean, it's hard. Like, catcher is an obvious upgrade spot, but outside of that, it's hard to figure out where you make a lot of moves unless you subtract somebody. So
the way the NL Central is right now, the way that the division is right now, I mean, no one expected the Brewers to be where they were at in 2020 and 2020.
Perpetually, right? We never expect the Brewers to maintain after their moves, and they always do.
The Cubs are one or two moves away from being, in my mind, at this moment, based on how everybody else looks. You know, the Reds took a step back because of their injuries. The Pirates are kind of on the up and up. We don't know what's going to go on the Cardinals. And then the Brewers are obviously still in contention for where they should be based on how they performed in 2024. But the Cubs are only one or two moves away from being, the division favorite next season. They were the favorite in 2024. They underperformed. There's no doubt about that. But if you can find a way, if you're Jed Hoyer, and you can find a way to move a couple of those prospects for some big major league talent, and I think he can do that with what he has sitting in his pocket right now, it's hard to make the Cubs not a favorite for the National League Central in 2025 if they do it right.
Yeah, they have the potential. They have the money. They have, you know, the new manager and Craig Counsell after the first season. They have everything there except for figuring out offense at home. Right. That ballpark was one of the most suppressive environments in baseball last year. This has somehow been a full episode already. We have so much we didn't even get to here on First Pitch. Stick around. We'll be back tomorrow with more news about who gets a qualifying offer and who doesn't. And if any signings happen right away, we'll break them down. Until next time, this has been First Pitch.